Good morning. This is Jane on a chilly December 9th, Tuesday, and I will be reading to you from the Decatur Herald and Review. We'll start with a cute first pager, Running Santas Lead Decatur's Christmas Parade. Annie Kirby and her 11-year-old daughter Hadley were dressed alike for the Decatur Christmas Parade. However, their matching attire wasn't just a fashion statement. The mother-daughter duo took part in the Santa Shuffle, a group of runners and walkers that led the annual parade. Kirby and her friends have organized other runs in Central Illinois events in which her daughter has participated. "Summer is in shorts, and it's fun. It's really sweaty," Hadley said. "In the winter, it's cold. You have to wear a lot of pants and sweatshirts." Santa Shuffle organizers gave the runners an extra layer of protection. Kyle May is the owner of Fleet Feet, an athletic apparel and shoe store that sponsors the event. "Everybody that signs up gets a full Santa suit. It does not breathe very well." Each runner and walker who signed up was given a one-size-fits-all felt Santa suit, including a hat, pants, jacket, belt, and beard, fit for adults or children. The 1.5-mile run was along the traditional Decatur parade route. Those who wanted to take the shorter route stopped at Decatur Brew Works on East William Street, more than half a mile along the route. Tracy Albert was one of the walkers who took the shorter route for this year's Santa Shuffle. "It's great to participate and see all the people in the community," she said. "The Santa suit is an added bonus. I have three," Albert said about her growing wardrobe. "It's the same exact suit." Nearly 70 runners, walkers, families, and even athletic shoe vendors took part in this year's event, which is also a fundraiser with donations accepted for Dove Incorporated. Other businesses stepped in to help the runners once they all met up at Brew Works. Partnerships included restaurants such as Papa Murphy's Pizza, Notorious P.I.G., and Coffee Connection. By the end of the race, several of the runners had worked up a sweat, despite the temperatures hovering around freezing. "These Santa suits, they get a little warm," May said, "and I just have a shirt and shorts underneath." Runners weren't the only Santas to take part in the Santa Shuffle. Four members of the Decatur Bicycle Club rode along on their decorated bikes while runners set the pace. "We're kind of the bike marshals," said Emily Steele. "We're in front of the runners to lead the way a bit." Although the bikers wore the same Santa outfit given to the runners, they had to accessorize with their protective gear. Each helmet had its own decorations. "Safety first," Steele said. "We customize our hats," Rusty Hodges said, "but I need it to stay on my bike helmet." Mauiqua resident Candace Cox watched the parade from the starting point with her 7-year-old son Leyland. Although the family enjoyed the herd of Santas running past to start the colorful parade, the excitement lay ahead of them, they said. "This gets you in the spirit," Cox said after the runners took off. "I think seeing Santa Clauses closes everything out. It brings everything to fruition." Cox suggested the runners take on a different name along with their holiday responsibility, treating them more like elves. "The Running Santas," she said, "because Santa probably can't run too many cookies." Now, on a more serious note, but also on the front page, a local Illinois story. Illinois educators hope to tackle the thorny issue of math competence. Each year, the Illinois State Board of Education releases an annual report card with data showing how students are doing in the basic subjects of reading, writing, and math. And each year, when those numbers come out, reporters, teachers, parents, and school officials sift through the data looking for evidence to show whether scores are improving, holding steady, or getting worse. But one trend has been so consistent over the years, it rarely draws much public attention. Overall, students score lower in math than they do in English language arts. That was true on the 2025 report card, which showed only 38.4% of Illinois students overall scored proficient or better in math, compared to 52.4% in English language arts. Illinois students are not unique in that regard. Nationwide, according to the National Assessment of Educational Progress, also known as the Nation's Report Card, 59% of 8th graders in 2024 scored at or above the basic level in math, the achievement level most closely aligned with grade level expectations, compared to 66% who did so in reading. Even on the international stage, American students do not perform as well in math as their counterparts in many other industrialized democracies. Scores from the 2023 Trends in International Mathematics and Science Study, or the TIMSS exam, a project of the U.S. Department of Education's National Center for Education Statistics, showed 8th grade students in the U.S. on average scored below their peers in countries like Singapore, Japan, Sweden, and Australia. In Illinois, officials at the State Board of Education hope to close the gap through the development of a statewide comprehensive numeracy plan. The document will direct not just the way math is taught in the classroom, but how math teachers are trained in the profession and math programs are administered in school districts. Latrenda Knighton, a retired math teacher who is now president of the National Council of Teachers of Mathematics, says the difficulty many Americans have with math is now so common it has become socially acceptable for people to openly admit that they are just not a math person. It's like a badge of honor to some people, she said in an interview with Capital News Illinois. What you say publicly aloud has a huge impact on impressionable young minds and their outlook on a subject or content area, or their beliefs about themselves. So we have to change that. We can no longer accept that it's okay to say, oh, I'm just not good at math, and so it's okay if I don't understand this. You should say, why is it that I can't make sense of this? But Beth McDonald, an education professor at Illinois State University who trains prospective teachers to teach math in early elementary grades, said she believes the problem of lagging math skills in America is not just a cultural issue. It's more about how we teach mathematics. McDonald traces much of the problem with today's math education techniques to the No Child Left Behind Act of 2001. That's the signature education policy law of the George W. Bush administration that mandated standardized testing in public schools nationwide and tied federal funding to those test results. When you go into a school, you'll see educators all on the same page of the curriculum on the same day, and they're being held accountable to stay on pace with the curriculum, she said. So what we've removed now is the need to even understand where our kids are in their own learning. Knighton said she has been paying close attention to a project underway in Illinois, where the Illinois State Board of Education hopes to reverse the trend by developing a comprehensive numeracy plan aimed at boosting students' math skills statewide. She also has had conversations with stakeholders at the state board in the early stages of the project. And from what I have observed, one of the things they've done is looked at this holistically, she said. They actually are looking at developing a plan and actually identifying what numeracy is so that people are understanding it. It's not just that we want to raise students' ability to memorize math facts. We're looking at building procedural knowledge from conceptual understanding. The planning process was modeled after the recent development of a statewide literacy plan, which lawmakers mandated in 2023 and ISBE formally adopted the following year. Unlike the literacy plan, however, the numeracy plan did not begin with a legislative mandate, but was instead initiated by State Superintendent of Education Tony Sanders. It began in April and May when ISBE staff conducted a needs assessment survey of various stakeholder groups, including teachers and other classroom staff, school and district administrators, and regional superintendents of education, to get a clearer sense of what needs to be included in a numeracy plan. The agency then held a summit meeting in June to study the survey results and form a team to begin drafting a numeracy plan. An initial draft of the plan was released in October. The agency then held a series of listening sessions to receive feedback from teachers and other educators, which concluded in November. Numeracy is more than arithmetic or the memorization of procedures, reads an initial draft of the plan. As defined in this guidance, numeracy is the ability for all students to confidently understand, interpret, and apply mathematical concepts across all domains of mathematics in a variety of real-world and academic contexts. Much of the 94-page document is technical in nature. One person who took part in November 4th virtual listening session described it as wordy, with discussion of topics such as the difference between, quote, traditional and reform approaches to mathematical instruction. But it also includes discussion of topics that suggest solving the problem of lagging math skills could be costly. Those include the lack of resources in school districts that are still funded far below their adequacy target, and the need for more training and professional development for teachers, to name just a few. Agency officials plan to present a second draft of the plan to the State Board in February. A final draft is expected to be completed in June. I think they're doing a great job with the numeracy plan so far, with regard to how policy can change, McDonald said. But we need some money behind a lot of these initiatives. Now here's an editorial from the State House, a Rich Miller editorial. Blaming Safe-T Act is easy, but ignores the facts. Safe-T is an acronym, SAFE-T. In the days after the horrific burning of a woman on a Chicago CTA train by a clearly deranged habitual criminal suspect last month, some in the news media immediately focused on their go-to issue, the Safe-T Act. Illinois leaders blast Safe-T Act after repeat offender charged with lighting woman on fire on CTA Blue Line, reported WGN-TV, as just one example. Former Cook County and federal prosecutor Bob Milan told the station, the Safe-T Act forces state's attorneys to file petitions instead of just giving judges the discretion to detain arrested suspects. Kankakee County Sheriff Mike Downey also demanded that judges be given 100% discretion to detain anyone they viewed as a danger to society. Several other sheriffs have since weighed in with the same demand, although some also want to increase the number of what are known as, quote, detainable offenses, which are alleged crimes that allow judges to keep suspects locked up ahead of trial. The state law was mentioned repeatedly because the prime suspect, Lawrence Reed, was not held in custody in August after he attacked a social worker in a psychiatric center, knocking her unconscious, giving her a concussion and damaging her eye. However, Reed was charged in August with aggravated battery resulting in great bodily harm, which is a detainable offense under the Safe-T Act. Considering his long criminal history and lots of other factors, he was a prime candidate for pretrial detention. Cook County Judge Teresa Molina Gonzalez instead sided against prosecutors who argued for detention and with the public defender in the case, who said Reed was back on his meds and doing better. During the hearing, Judge Molina Gonzalez publicly acknowledged Reed's long list of 70-plus arrests and convictions, and according to CWBChicago.com, took a report from a court officer reclaiming that Reed's chances of committing another crime was 4 out of 6 if released, with a likelihood of violence. After saying she couldn't lock up everyone that prosecutors wanted detained, the judge ended up placing Reed on monitored home confinement. Then another judge subsequently loosened that restriction. So much for the idea of giving judges complete discretion without prosecutor involvement. It's worth noting that pretty much all of Reed's previous offenses and releases happened under the cash bail system before the Safety Act's pretrial fairness provisions took effect in September 2023, a fact ignored by the detractors. Also, the Cook County Jail has experienced a 16% point increase in inmates between the end of last year through the end of this year's third quarter, according to a Loyola tracking dashboard. The county's jail population was about 8% higher at the end of the third quarter than it was just before the Safety Act was fully enacted. And a chart recently posted by CWBChicago.com, which focuses exclusively on crime and is not exactly known as a liberal site, shows that a wide array of violent offenses committed by people awaiting trial in Cook County dropped from 116 victims in 2021, before the Safety Act, to 52 last year, and 37 so far this year. Attempted murder victims dropped from 50 victims in 2022 to 8 so far this year. The point being, too many reporters, pundits, and others are far too quick to bring up everybody's favorite bogeyman before any facts are known or even acknowledged. Is the Safety Act perfect? Of course not. No law designed by human beings can ever be perfect. Could it be improved? Again, humans should always try to improve their work. But the people at the table should not be the ones who are angrily and ignorantly preening for the TV cameras. Also, one of those downstate sheriffs advocating for changes in the Safety Act kind of let the cat out of the bag last week. In addition to granting judges more discretion and increasing the number of detainable offenses, Jefferson County Sheriff Jeff Bullard talked about the loss of local revenues with the abolition of cash bail. The old bail system helped fund an array of things like jail staffing, victim services, and law enforcement, Bullard said. The elimination of cash bail has created financial gaps for counties statewide, the sheriff claimed. Oddly, though, Sheriff Bullard also griped that, quote, some arrestees are now being held longer while awaiting a judge, where previously they could bond out quickly. So, the sheriff is upset that people deemed dangerous by judges are being held too long behind bars? That kind of makes sense. Makes me think that this is a lot about money. This kind of makes me think that this is a lot about money. Let's look at a few Decatur area obituaries, starting with Larry Arthur Haubner, age 83, of Decatur, Illinois, who passed away on October 21st, 2025 at Decatur Memorial Hospital. A service for Larry will be held on Thursday, December 11th, 2025 at First Christian Church. Visitation will be at 10 a.m., followed by a funeral service at 11 a.m. Next, Charlotte Faye Pickett of Decatur passed away on November 29th, 2025. Family and friends will be invited to a private celebration of life event to be held later this month. Donations in Charlotte's memory may be directed to the Humane Society of Decatur and Macon County or St. Jude's. Now here's some national news that might affect some newborns that you know. The headline reads, Investing in Babies. What if all children, regardless of their family's circumstances, could get a financial boost when they turn 18? That's the idea behind Trump accounts, a lesser-known provision of President Donald Trump's tax and spending cuts law signed this year. It gives $1,000 to every newborn, so long as their parents open an account. Private firms will invest that money in the stock market, and a child can access the funds when they turn 18. The parents of older children also can open accounts, but they won't get the $1,000 bonus. Backers say it's a way to bolster capitalism and help children from low-income households to build wealth at a time when socialist candidates are growing more popular. Thanks to donation billionaires Michael and Susan Dell, announced December 2nd, some children 10 and under could receive $250 in seed money if their parents open an account. That money is reserved for kids who live in zip codes with a median family income of $150,000 or less and won't get the $1,000 bonus from the Treasury. Here's what you need to know. First, what is a Trump account? It's a new tool where money is invested in the stock market on behalf of a child. The child can't access the money until they turn 18 and can use it only for specific purposes such as paying tuition, starting a business, or making a down payment on a home. Disbursements from the accounts will be subject to taxes. After a parent opens an account, the U.S. Treasury will contribute $1,000 for newborns. Private banks and brokerages will manage the money, which must be invested in U.S. equity index funds that track the stock market and charge the accounts no more than 0.1% in annual fees. Parents can contribute up to $2,500 annually in pre-tax income, much like a retirement account. Parents, employers, relatives, friends, and local governments and philanthropic groups can also pitch in. Yearly contributions are capped at $5,000, but contributions from governments and charities don't count toward that total. Who gets $1,000? To qualify for the $1,000 bonus, a baby must be a U.S. citizen, have a Social Security number, and be born between January 1, 2025 and December 31, 2028. Any parent can open an account for a qualifying child, regardless of the parent's immigration status. Children born before 2025 won't qualify for the $1,000 incentive, but parents can open accounts for them as long as they're under 18. Parents can invest up to $2,500 pre-tax dollars for those kids, and they may benefit from the Dell's donation. How do I open an account? The accounts won't be open for contributions until July 2026, but parents of eligible kids can sign up now by filling out Form 4547 from the Internal Revenue Service. In May, parents who sign up will get information about how to finish opening the accounts. Beginning in July, the White House says it will have a website where parents can register for the accounts. What's the idea behind this? Backers say they want to introduce more people to the stock market and give even children born into poverty a chance to benefit from it. They believe the accounts will help combat the rising popularity of socialism and offer more people the opportunity to build wealth. About 58% of U.S. households held stocks or bonds in 2022, according to the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, though the wealthiest 1% owned almost half the value of stocks that year. California, Connecticut, and the District of Columbia piloted, quote, baby bonds programs that are similar to Trump accounts in some ways. Other states, including Maryland, are weighing such programs. However, those programs target youth growing up in poverty or foster care, plus children who lost a parent to COVID-19. Wealthier children don't benefit. They're also managed by the state, not private investment firms. What do critics say? Critics say the accounts do little to help children in their early years, when they're most vulnerable and most likely to be in poverty. They also say the accounts do little to offset the cuts Trump administration and congressional Republicans made to programs that benefit young people and their families, including food assistance and Medicaid. Republicans created the accounts in the same Trump tax bill that reduced spending for some of those programs. Critics also say the Trump accounts will widen the wealth gap. Affluent families that can afford to make the maximum pre-tax contribution will realize the greatest benefits. poor families who can't afford to set aside money for the accounts will benefit the least. Assuming a 7% return, the $1,000 seed money would grow to about $3,570 over 18 years. Now, here's a piece from the Chicago Tribune having to do with Costco, a place where I do a lot of my shopping. Costco has become a symbol of American abundance. It's a place where you can buy a 10-pound rack of ribs, Christmas lights, a new winter coat, shoes for your kids, a flat-screen TV, or those delicious gluten-free macarons. You can get a massive slice of pizza for $1.99. If you're a hungry high schooler, you can buy the whole pie for about $10. A handful of viral videos on TikTok and X show people from communist countries such as Cuba, as well as former Soviet bloc nations, having emotional reactions as they first experience the store's aisles of plenty, wandering awestruck amid cases of oversized meats, prepared food, and clothing. To some degree, most of us feel that sense of wonder when we walk into one of those warehouses. The point is, Costco is a beloved part of American culture. It's a place where you can get a good deal and meal, and about 1,000 other things. And as President Donald Trump's tariffs were on the company's naughty list this season, Costco is suing the Trump administration, asking the courts to overturn the sweeping tariffs imposed beginning in February under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, and arguing the law doesn't actually give the president authority to levy import duties without the approval of Congress. The retailer is also seeking refunds of tariffs it has already paid this year. Costco has not disclosed the cost it has incurred due to Trump's trade wars, but it's certain to be a lot. And when one of America's biggest retailers is forced to shoulder substantial new tariff costs, a fair chunk of those expenses show up in its price tags. Ordinary Americans pay that freight. Americans trust Costco with a kind of bipartisan affection that's rare in today's politically fraught consumer landscape. The chain symbolizes value, fairness, stability, and competence, traits many voters feel our politics lack. When a brand with that sort of credibility publicly challenges the president's signature economic policy, it punctures Trump's narrative that his tariffs primarily hit foreign governments rather than American consumers and businesses. Costco has loads of clout with suburban families, small business owners, and other middle-income shoppers who watch prices closely. What they say and do matters. The mega retailer isn't the only company that's challenged Trump's tariffs. Learning Resources, LLC, a toy maker, also filed suit, as did Revlon and Kawasaki Motors. The Supreme Court recently heard arguments on the challenge by Learning Resources and is expected to decide within the next few months. If the court rules against Trump, it would deal a major blow to what has become a central plank of the president's trade agenda. Trump can shrug off criticism from economists or Democrats, but when one of the country's most beloved brands says his trade policy is misguided, it risks shifting the conversation from ideology to everyday life, where Trump's message is the most vulnerable. Now, here's a fun fact from Today in History. On this date in 1965, A Charlie Brown Christmas, the first animated TV special featuring characters from the Peanuts comic strip by Charles Schulz, premiered on CBS. Boy, if my math is right, that means this is the 60th anniversary of A Charlie Brown Christmas, which I do watch every year without fail. I hope you do too. The music is lovely.